the sound of drums and gongs. The heat of summer had begun in earnest. At noon, the sun scorched overhead, and the familiar slow drone of the popsicle man floated in through the open windows, accompanied by the rhythmic clap of a wooden block on a box. Ice-cold popsicles, green bean popsicles, red bean popsicles, ice-cold popsicles. My hands sweated so much holding the wool that I could not knit. Instead, I worked on embroidering a pillow sham as I waited for the cool of the evening. In the distance, I could hear the sound of drums and gongs. There was a tension in the air that even we children felt. The newspapers and radio were full of the campaign to destroy the four olds. The campaign had been expanded to eliminate personal possessions. "If we do not completely eliminate the roots, the plant will grow back," we heard. "We must eradicate these relics of the past. We must not allow the reactionary forces to hoard their treasures." And every day we heard the drums and gongs that meant the Red Guards were ransacking the houses of class enemies to find and confiscate their hoarded possessions. One day the drums and gongs approached closer than I had ever heard them before. Ji-Yun and her classmate, Xiao Hong-Yin, ran into the house, full of the news. "It's a search party, all right," Ji-Yun shouted. "They came from Old Man Rong's factory in trucks, and they posted a Dao Zibao. Come on, let's go see." She dragged me down the stairs. A crowd was already gathering at number 11, Old Mr. Rong's house. Two dark trucks blocked the entry. The sides of the trucks were covered with red banners that said things like, "Sweep away all the reactionary monsters," and "Destroy the four olds and establish the four news." The big iron gate in front of the building was closed, but there was an unusual clamor coming from inside the house. The indistinct shouts of the Red Guards mingled with the furious barking of Mrs. Rong's huge dog. We could only imagine what was going on inside. A Dao Zibao was posted on the gate, and a solemn crowd had gathered around to read it, wiping their faces with handkerchiefs and shading their heads with palm leaf fans. Du Hai's mother was there, along with another neighborhood party officer. I pushed my way between the people so I could read the Dao Zibao. "Though the capitalist Rong Dafeng has died, his widow still lives on his ill-gotten gains. The factories in which her husband exploited the masses have been returned to their rightful owners, the workers and the people's government. Yet the reactionary monster still lives on the blood of the workers. Instead of admitting her crimes and striving to atone for her sins, Old Lady Rong has sent her sons to Hong Kong, where they can continue to exploit the Chinese people, and she herself continues to flaunt her bourgeois life. The Red Guards have determined to eradicate the roots of this noxious weed in order to promote Chairman Mao's revolutionary cause." I had never seen a search, except in the movies. I knew that they were the only way we were going to get rid of the four olds, once and for all. Still, there was something about the idea that made me nervous. Ji-Yun pulled on my arm.
"Ji-Li, what does noxious mean?"
Before I could answer her, Grandma was at my shoulder.
"Ji-Li, help me carry this bag. Ji-Yun, come along home, now."
She hustled us away. Ji-Yun was still jabbering excitedly, but Grandma was stern.
"You children, stay in the house this afternoon, you hear? That's nothing for you to gawk at."
When Ji-Yun came back in, he was thrilled too. He had spent part of the day in the park and had missed some of the excitement.
"I saw them driving away a truck just full of stuff. I'm going back to see what else they got."
"You'll do nothing of the kind," Grandma said sharply. "Those poor people have enough to worry about without your going to stare at them."
I was not sure who Grandma was worried about, the Red Guards or Mrs. Rong, but it was clear that she did not want us involved. All that afternoon I was restless. I pictured Mrs. Rong sitting under guard, cursing because her four olds were being found. I imagined the searchers ransacking the trunks and drawers and drilling holes in the walls to look for hidden valuables. It seemed both inspiring and scary. When Grandma asked me to buy her some soy sauce,
I could not help seizing the opportunity to go past number 11 and take another look. People just getting home from work had swelled the crowd at the gate. Some of them were clustered in front of the Daozibao, but many more were talking in small groups. Children ran up and down the alley, around and through the knots of people. One boy dared to hit a gong, and the clang startled everyone. The alley fell into silence. Everyone turned to look at the boy, and he scurried to stand behind his father. The conversation continued in hushed tones.
"It's no surprise to me," said a woman I recognized as the housekeeper from number 9. "Every day when she went out all dolled up, I said to myself, 'She is heading for a fall.'
Last New Year's, she went out with a new diamond ring, bigger than I ever saw before," another old woman said. "Mrs. Bang's housekeeper told me it was over 3 carats. And the clothes she had made in Hong Kong. Every time somebody else got a new dress, you could be sure Mrs. Rong would get a prettier one."
"Yes, and the taxi cabs, and the dinners, and mahjong all night sometimes."
I moved closer to the Daozibao on the gate. "They said she had hundreds of thousands of yuan in the bank."
"I heard 1 million. My uncle worked in one of his factories before liberation, and he knew all about old Rong."
This was Mr. Ni, the man we called Six Fingers because of the extra finger on his right hand. He lived in one of the converted garages in our alley.
"The antiques they carried out a while ago must have been worth 1 million all by themselves."
"And there was that trunk full of gold bars. They could hardly carry it."
There was satisfaction in their voices. The gate opened with a loud clang, and I jumped. 8 men struggled out with a huge mahogany 4-poster bed. It was just like Mom and Dad's bed, with a mirror in the headboard surrounded by carved dragons. Most of the crowd murmured in admiration, but I also heard an indignant snort.
"Typical capitalist," said a ragged-looking old woman.
I blushed. Our family had a capitalist bed, too. I turned and made my way out of the crowd. The sound of drums and gongs drew near again. I saw Grandma wince. "Who is it this time?" she muttered. "You children stay in the house this afternoon." She wearily turned back to the kitchen. Everyone could identify the sounds of a search, and we had grown expert at locating them in the neighborhood. After 6 more searches had been conducted in our alley, they were no longer exciting, but the adults I knew grew more and more tense. Only Ji Yong was still enthusiastic about them. He always seemed to know the latest stories.
"The housekeeper at number 18 told the searchers that there were gold bars hidden in the toilet tank," he laughed. "At number 27, where Liu's mistress lives, they found his wife's jewelry.
And, most riveting of all,
they found real weapons at number 38.
His voice was hushed with excitement.
"They went up into the attic and looked in the old chimney, and they found a gun."
"And do you know what else?"
Song Po Po added, really speaking to Grandma rather than to us.
"Six Fingers is always at every search. He's too sick to work at the light bulb factory, but he's not too sick to go to every search and carry things out. He has all the roughest little children organized into a kind of posse to help keep order. He says he's proud to be doing his part."
Grandma raised her head, but I heard no response. It was hard to imagine where Song Po Po heard so much news. When neighbors ran into each other, they did not stop to chat, but just nodded and hurried on. Everyone felt vulnerable, and no one wanted to say anything that would cause trouble. We children were warned to stay close to home and come back at once if a search occurred. Only some of the few working-class people in the alley still seemed excited when they heard the drums and gongs. In other years, summer vacation had been a happy time. In the daytime, we went to the pool or to the movies or to the park to turn somersaults and roll on the grass. Evenings, we sat in the alley with the neighbors and listened to stories. We would watch the moon and sing and giggle until very late. Now things were different. An Yi had been sent away to spend the summer with her grandparents in Shandong, away from Shanghai's turbulence. I missed her terribly. I saw hardly any kids in the neighborhood. No one came out to play. There seemed to be no laughter in the alley. Just a growing, choking tension. Things got so bad that Mom and Dad decided to dismiss Song Po Po. I heard Mom speaking to her in the kitchen. "We really hate to let you go, but if the Red Guards found out, they would accuse us of exploiting working people." Mom's voice sounded uncomfortable. She paused for a moment, then continued, "We want to give you this in thanks." That evening, Song Po Po carried a small bag downstairs with her. Her eyes were red, and she seemed even more hunchbacked than usual. I did not know why she seemed so sad. Song Po Po was part of the family, and it was good that she was not working for us. It meant we were not exploiting her. I thought of everything Song Po Po had done for us. On rainy days, she would meet us at the school gate with 3 pairs of boots in a plastic bag and 2 umbrellas under her arm. Often, she was half-soaked when we got home, but we were always perfectly dry. When we ate up all the sweets Grandma bought us and wanted more, Song Po Po would buy us a popsicle or a sweet roll out of her own limited funds. Unlike other housekeepers, Song Po Po could read. Not only books, but music, too. Sometimes when we passed her door, we would see her sitting in her wicker chair with a music book in her hand, humming a folk song from her hometown. Ji-young and Ji-yun would throw themselves into her lap and try to sing along, while I would stand behind her and play with her naturally curly hair. My 4th aunt once told me that people with naturally curly hair were fated to suffer. That was certainly true in Song Po Po's case. She had come from a wealthy family, but her husband had committed suicide after his business went bankrupt. All their money went to pay his debts, and she had had to become a housekeeper. It was very sad, and when I remembered this, I was even happier we were no longer exploiting her. She still lived in the small room downstairs. We could still visit her and play with her fascinating hair. But we no longer heard her happy humming, and she no longer bought us treats or met us with umbrellas when it rained. With Song Po Po gone, there was a lot more work for us to do. Excited at the idea of getting up and going out at dawn, I volunteered to buy meat and vegetables at the market. This was the hardest job, but considering Grandma's age, she was over 70, and Mom's and Dad's busy schedules, I felt it was my duty. It was also a good chance to get rid of my remaining bourgeois habits. The first few days, I was overwhelmed. I couldn't identify some of the vegetables I was supposed to buy. I couldn't tell if the fish was fresh or not. Most of all, facing so many people and so many lines, I was totally lost. Each item had its own line, and everything was first come, first served. Often, after standing in a long line for one vegetable, I found that everything else I needed was sold out. Even items that required ration coupons ran out early. But I learned fast. Soon I knew how to pick the best produce and the freshest fish, how to choose the right lines to buy the best food in the shortest time. I learned to stand in one line while having my place held in another, so I could be sure of getting everything Grandma wanted, despite the shortages. Every morning at 5:30, I left the alley. I hurried through the empty streets, feeling excited and proud. I was a grown-up now, doing a grown-up's job. I was clearly not one of the pampered bourgeoisie. One day, Grandma got sick, and I took over the cooking as well. When the old square German clock struck 12, Ji-young appeared at my shoulder. "You said lunch would be ready by now," he grumbled. "Just stop bothering me, will you?" I pushed my sweaty hair off my forehead. The kitchen, located on the landing and crammed with pots and pans and a 2-burner gas stove, was crowded and stuffy. With the heat from the sun outside and the heat from the stove in front of me, I was simply melting. I turned to the instructions Mom had left for me. "Steam the eggs for 20 minutes, then add some soy sauce. I lifted the cover of the wok and gasped in dismay. Oh, no. The bowl holding the eggs must have overturned into the boiling water. Now, instead of steamed eggs, I had a pot full of egg soup. I decided to mix the egg soup with the rice, which I had burned earlier anyway. I poured soy sauce into the whole mess and shouted, "Lunch is ready!" Ji-young did not seem as hungry as he had been. Ji-yun picked at her plate. Grandma said I did very well, but I noticed she hardly ate anything either. I worried that her arthritis had gotten worse, even though she had been lying down all morning. "Can I get anything for you, Grandma?" I asked. "No, I'll be all right. When your mother gets home, I'll have her take me to the clinic for acupuncture. That always helps."
"We can take you to the clinic," Ji-young said.
I gave him a questioning look.
"The neighborhood party committee has a pedicab in their courtyard," he said. "You can borrow it if someone in your family is sick. I can ride it if you help me get started."
"Sweetie, that's nice of you to offer, but I think you'd better get some experience first," Grandma said.
"I've ridden it lots of times."
Ji-young saw my face, and just as Grandma coughed, he amended softly, "Well, a few anyway, to practice." "Mom won't be home till late," I pondered aloud. "If we help push, and Ji-young goes slowly, we can do it." "If you're sure," Grandma said. She must have been in a lot of pain. That decided me. Ji-yun helped Grandma down the steps, while Ji-young and I got the pedicab. Standing in front of us, it seemed much bigger, much blacker, much less friendly than I remembered. Slowly, we pushed it back to our house. Grandma clambered stiffly into the covered seat and back, and we set off. Ji-young's legs were too short, so he had to stand up to turn the pedals. Ji-yun and I pushed from behind. The pedicab moved cautiously down the alley and entered the busy street. The traffic light turned red, and the pedicab slowed down as Ji-young pressed the handbrake. We came to a smooth stop. Ji-young gave a confident smile, and I began to relax. The light turned green. Ji-young stood up on the pedals again, but the pedicab did not move.
"Push!" he shouted, and I leaned into the pedicab with all my might.
At last it began to move. We had just mastered a slight rise and had reached the middle of an intersection when a bus horn blared in my ear. The light had changed without our realizing it, and the bus driver was waving at us to get out of the way. I gave a start and nearly fell, just as Ji-young picked up some speed. By the time I recovered, the pedicab was 10 yards in front of me and gaining. Ji-yun had stopped when she saw me slip. Now we both ran after the pedicab. Ahead of us, Ji-young turned back to smile at Grandma, and the pedicab swerved crazily toward the curb. I shouted. Ji-young turned back and yanked on the handlebars. One back wheel jolted up over the sidewalk and back down to the street. Ji-young did not slow down. We finally caught up to them at the next red light. As we panted up to the pedicab, the light changed.
"Push!"
Ji-young shouted over his shoulder. I shook my head.
"You'd better slow down. You nearly made Grandma fall out when you hit that curb."
I looked into the pedicab and saw Grandma kneading her hands nervously. "Ji-young has already promised me to be more careful," she said, with a stern glance at his back. From his sheepish smile, I knew that she had given him a real scolding. All the rest of the way to the clinic, and all the way home again, we drove slowly and carefully. Even Ji-young gave a sigh of relief when we were back in the alley at last. But I heard him boast to Mom when she got home from work.
"It was easy," he said. "Anytime Grandma needs to go to the clinic, we'll just take her."
Dad was often kept late at the theater, and sometimes he did not come home until after we were in bed. There were a lot of meetings, he told us. Often I would wake up when I heard him come in, and as I went back to sleep, I heard him and Mom talking in low voices. They must have made their decision about the trunks at one of those late-night conferences, but the first we knew about it was on a Sunday morning when they started carrying the trunks up to the roof. The four trunks were part of Grandma's dowry. They were a rich red leather with a pattern stamped in gold. Each trunk had two sets of brass locks on its front and a round brass handle on each end. When they were stacked up on their rack, they made our room shine. Now Dad was going to dye them black so that they would not be considered four-olds. Four stools were waiting in the middle of the roof, and the first chest was placed upon them. The dark dye was already mixed. Dad set to work.
"Wait a minute," exclaimed Grandma.
There was a dark stain about the size of a thumbprint on one of the brass handles. She took out her handkerchief and rubbed the handle over and over until it was clean and bright. She looked at the chest with a dreamy expression and gently laid her hand on it. Against the deep red leather, her skin seemed even paler.
"It won't look bad after it's painted," Dad said softly.
Grandma seemed to wake up.
"Oh, I know," she said. "You go ahead."
She went down to the room and did not come back.
"Her mother gave her these trunks when Grandma got married. That's why she's sad," Dad explained.
I thought of Grandma getting married so long ago, bringing the four beautiful trunks full of gifts her mother had sent from Tianjin to Shanghai. Grandma must have been excited and exhausted, traveling 1,000 miles to marry a man she had never met. Dad started to paint, wielding the brush awkwardly.
"Dad, it's too dry. Look how it's streaking."
Dad dipped the brush in the dye again.
"Look out! It's dripping, Dad!"
Shouting advice, we ran around the trunks excitedly. Eventually, Dad's painting improved and the first trunk was finished. But the original color could still be seen through the dye, and he had to put on a second coat. Ji-Yun and I grew tired of watching and went back downstairs. Ji-Yong stayed to help. An amazing sight stopped the two of us in the doorway.
"Wow," Ji-Yun said.
Glowing silks and satin spilled out of an old trunk. The whole room was alive with color. Ji-Yun grabbed a piece of silk.
"Gorgeous! Are these costumes, Mom?"
They were old clothes, long gowns like the ones ancient courtiers and scholars wore in the movies. Many of them were embroidered with golden dragons or phoenixes. Some were printed with magnificent, colorful patterns, and some were even crusted with pearls and gold sequins. "These belonged to our ancestors. Grandma thought they were too nice to throw away, so we kept them in the bottom of this chest." Mom reached in and pulled out a bunch of colorful silk neckties. She threw them all on the floor. I was worried.
"Mom, aren't these all four-olds?"
"That's right. That's why Grandma and I decided to make comforter covers out of them. We can use the ties to make a mop."
"It seems terrible to just cut them all up. Why don't we just give them to the theater or to the Red Guards?"
Ji-Yun held a gown up in front of her. She was imagining what it would be like to wear it, I knew.
"The theater doesn't need them, and it's too late to turn them in now. The Red Guards would say that we were hiding them and waiting for New China to fall. Besides, even if we did turn them in, the Red Guards would just burn them anyway."
Grandma looked at me and shook her head as she picked up her scissors.
"I just couldn't bear to sell them," she said sadly. "Even when your father was in college and we needed money." She picked up a lovely gold-patterned robe and said softly, "This was a government official's uniform. I remember my grandfather wearing it."
"It is pretty, Grandma," I said.
"But it is four-olds.
Don't feel bad about it."
The long gowns were so large that the back of one was big enough for half a quilt cover. Mom and Grandma discussed the job while cutting, which parts could be used for covers and which parts for cushions. Ji-Yun and I were enchanted by the pearls and gold sequins littering the floor. We pestered Grandma and Mom to let us have them, and finally Mom sighed and yielded. Ji-Yun and I were overjoyed. We sat amid the piles of silks, picking up pearls and putting them in a jar. Little White was happy, too. She rolled over and over among the scraps of silk and batted pearls around the floor. While we played, Mom made two quilt covers out of the gowns, one deep purple and the other a bright gold. Then she made a pair of mops from the ties. We were delighted with them. You could not find anything like our tie mops in the stores. Dad and Ji-young finally finished the second coat of dye on the trunks. The gold stamping still obstinately showed through the layers, but the deep red had become a dark burgundy. The room seemed dressed up with the glowing new quilts and the repainted trunks. I felt good. We had really done what Chairman Mao asked, breaking with the old and establishing the new. "You did a nice job on the trunks," Grandma said. "I don't think the Red Guards will notice them." Ji-yun looked up from the bed where she was lying with her face in the silky new cover. "Are the Red Guards going to come and search our house?" Everyone stood still. I stopped playing with the pearls. Even Little White stopped rolling around the floor. "It's possible," Mom said slowly. "But you don't have to be afraid. You are just children, and a search would have nothing to do with you." The new decor lost all its brightness. The pearls I had been playing with lost their luster, and I put them down.